Hello, everybody. So this project was done by my master's student, Brent Sunderledge, at Southern Illinois University, where I was for about 3 years, and then I recently moved to North Carolina State University about a year and a half ago. So I'm still working in soil nutrition, but now I work with intensively managed lobelia pines instead of corn. So you'll be amazed, they're actually pretty similar in a lot of soil nutrient questions. So this project, we were looking at how different soil characteristics affected volatilization of urea or urea with a couple of different additives. So the idea being is we know that ammonia volatilization is controlled by several different soil characteristics as well as environmental variables, and we wanted to try to get a better idea of how to predict nitrogen loss based on certain which soil characteristics best controlled volatilization. So we also wanted to investigate a couple of different additives, NPPT plus NPPT, and then as well as another additive. I'll explain it more in a second. So we took a bunch of samples from a wide range of soil characteristics and did some lab incubations. So we put together, we did a fair amount of preliminary work putting together a field protocol. So this is my master's student, Brent. And so we took very superficial samples, because that's what we were doing broadcast applications, and we put together this little booklet, and we sent out boxes with ice packs and all this stuff, so that we could get a variety of soil samples from a wide range of soil types. So we got soil samples from, we were hoping to get 100, we got 79, so that's pretty good, from a lot of different kinds of soils, everything from very, very sandy soils to very clay soils, and you can see the difference in color, and all the stars of the locations where they came from. So we got a nice variety across a lot of different kinds of soil types, and several different kinds of crops. So just to give you an idea of characterization, the vast majority of these soils come from mollisols and alfasols, but we got a few from some other different soil orders. For soil texture, of course, these are coming from mostly agricultural soils, so a lot of silt loams and loams, silty clay loams. And then about half of the samples came from conventionally tilled soils and the other half from reduced and no-till. So we tried to get a decent characterization of kind of what all these soils were like and where they came from. So the characteristics that we looked at were organic matter, calcium chloride pH, total exchange capacity, and that's from the summation method. And so we did have some soils that came from carbonate soils, and so for those we did the fizz test, and if they were fizzy and had calcium carbonates, then we sent them to Colorado State for the exchange capacity using the correct method for carbonate soils. Looked at ammonia nitrate, and then also texture. In-house, we did another OH buffering capacity test to basically look at how well these soils had sort of capacity to buffer for pH increases. So we're going to call that OH buffer increase. And then we also looked at urease activity. So there was some literature that suggested that urease activity was a good indicator of volatilization. And so we did these incubations, adding urea, and then looked at how much of that was basically converted into ammonium. So that's our urease activity test. And then, of course, we had to do our ammonia volatilization. So we did a fair amount of preliminary work trying to figure out the best field capacity to do this at, and we centered in on 25% field capacity. When you have a bunch of different kinds of soils, you have to use field capacity instead of sort of a by-volume measurement. Because they have a wide variety of field capacities, and we found that if the field capacity was too high, if it was much over 25%, then we didn't get very much volatilization at all. So 25% gave us sort of the most amount of volatilization for these different kinds of soil types. So we sieved the urea so that we had uniform prills, did 168 kilograms. Nitrogen per hectare equivalent in our little laboratory cores, and then we added our urea, plus NPPT plus NPPT, which is lamus as the product, and then the maleic itaconic copolymer, or I'll call it MIP, from Nutrisphere, and then we soaked our cotton pads in phosphoric acid and caught the ammonium volatilization over 7 days. So you don't need to read any of this, but I think, as you all know, soil characteristics are interrelated. And so it can be really tricky to model soil characteristics and how they influence anything when you know that they're all interrelated. So we started off, I actually learned a fair amount more about statistics while we were doing this, and we started off with principal component analysis, but that doesn't let you model the effect on your dependent variable. So we went and talked to some statisticians and found a technique for modeling called LASSO. So it sort of was built out of principal component analysis, and then they came up with principal component regression, and then ridge regression, and now LASSO is the next sort of, is the best modeling method we have now for when you have a lot of multicollinearity between your variables. And so it'll actually eliminate variables if they are not the best predictors in your model. So it'll throw stuff out, whereas other models won't necessarily, like ridge regression. So we put all this into the model for the different volatilization experiments, and voila, our final results were basically that for urea without inhibitors, total exchange capacity is the best predictor of volatilization, which is great. It basically comes out to be the best sort of consolidated variable. So total exchange capacity, clay content, organic matter, and OH buffering capacity were all significant predictors in the model. Calcium chloride pH and urease activity were not. So urease activity was actually thrown out, totally out of the model. It was that bad. Okay, so keep that in your brain. Now if we add MBPT plus MPPT, it changes. So now the best predictor in the model is calcium chloride pH. So we were a little bit surprised by this until we did a little bit more digging into the literature and found some decay kinetic type literature that says if your pH is lower, it will degrade your MBPT faster. So total exchange capacity is still important, but pH becomes more important when you add your MBPT. OH buffering capacity, clay, organic matter, and urease activity. Again, urease activity was thrown out of the model completely again, which was sort of a surprise. I think my master's student was really hoping that was going to be the thing, but nope, got thrown out. Now if you go back to the urea plus MIP, it basically looks exactly the same as the model for urea. So back to total exchange capacity, organic matter, clay content, OH buffering capacity, OH buffering increase. Again, urease and pH not in the model. So, and these had pretty good predictive capabilities. So this is just to give you a little bit of an idea of the spread of the data. So you've got urea, urea with MIP, and then urea plus MBPT, plus MPPT, it's a mouthful. So you can see the urea plus the MIP is basically, it looks just exactly the same as the urea. But we had pretty good reduction in nitrogen loss with the MBPT plus MPPT. So that's the total exchange capacity. And then for pH, so I picked out the two of the best predictive variables. So we've got basically, again, very similar spread of data for urea plus and urea plus MIP. And then you know, you can see as your pH, if my little cursor works, yep. So as your pH decreases, you get increasing losses of nitrogen. So just to give you a summary of the results here for the actual amount of losses, so I forgot to change my little things here. So that's urea plus MIP and then urea plus MBPT. So basically about 25% losses without the inhibitor and then down to only about 6% losses with the MBPT plus MPPT. So a big reduction in nitrogen loss with that MBPT plus MPPT. Okay, so overall, and we wanted to do this because we wanted to have an idea of if a grower has a particular soil test, can we give them a better prediction of whether or not, you know, how badly do they need a urease inhibitor? And so with simple tests that they're going to get from a regular soil test, total exchange capacity, clay, organic matter, content, you can do a pretty good job of predicting how much volatilization you're going to have. And granted, that's on mineral soil. Okay, so we thought about doing, you know, residues, and we tried to figure out a way to do that, but it ended up being too big. So we just said, let's do mineral soil for this particular experiment. So things will change when you have residue, right? But basically, total exchange capacity was the best consolidated variable. But initial soil pH becomes very important when you have a urease inhibitor on. So that's going to change the degradation. So NBPTO, the oxygenated, it's got a long name, form, once it basically comes in contact with soil, is most likely degraded more rapidly with a lower pH. And then urease activity did not, at least this particular, you know, there's a few different kinds of ways you can look at urease activity. For this particular experiment, we didn't see any correlate. We didn't see any predictive capability of urease activity, except in one particular soil where there was basically no urease activity whatsoever. And we're like, well, that's weird. What's going on there? So we called the guys that collected the soil, and it turns out that it was under black plastic in a watermelon production system. And so urease activity is broken down after 40 degrees C or something like that. So we think the soil's probably got hot enough that it denatured all the urease. So we're like, oh, that makes sense. And then we didn't find any help from the MIP for reducing volatilization. So that's a quick overview. So just give a big thanks. So BASF funded this project. And Brent Sunderlidge did an amazing job. He graduated. He's now working as a researcher in the weed science program at SIU. And it's just got accepted for first look in SSSAJ. So it should be up online by now. We're still waiting for the copy proof. But this was a really fun project, and I have to give a big thanks for all the folks that helped with this. Okay.
Good. Thank you. We've got a question in the back, please. Could you stand, please, and ask your question?
How much was left? So with or without the inhibitor? So basically, if you look at how much was lost, so without the inhibitor, so this is after 7 days, so we had anywhere from all the way up to over 50% losses down to 5% depending on the soil. Is that?
Sorry,
the granules dissolve, like, yeah. The granules dissolve on like day one.
Yeah. In the back.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
Okay. So would the question is, would the model be different for below surface, subsurface applied urea? Yeah, I mean, we wouldn't expect, well, so actually we did another experiment that looked at how much volatilization you get if you incorporate your urea with and without inhibitors. And so actually if you incorporate your urea but very superficially, you still get a decent amount of volatilization. And so it kind of has to be, you know, 6 inches or below basically is sort of what we were seeing in terms of reducing volatilization. So I would expect you're not going to get much volatilization at all so long as you incorporate your urea, you know, below at 6 inches or so. But if you do, I would expect this to be the same basically if you're incorporating your urea in the very surface, because you do still get volatilization. And so we actually were recommending that if you're just doing very superficial tillage or incorporation of urea, it still would need a urease inhibitor.
Very good. Okay, thanks again, Richard. Appreciate it. Okay.